Hey, football fans, it's Andrew Filippone, host of the First and Pod podcast. Join me and my co-host, three-time All-Pro Patrick Peterson, as we break down every game every week. New episodes drop on Monday and Friday mornings. Be sure to subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chris Ronji, Amy Mark Scores with you, and we're looking at a story here that was written by Katie Cole in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I couldn't believe it as I was reading it. A man who was a face of crime prevention, a spokesperson and a crime interrupter for the program Cure Violence, himself has been arrested for working with a multi-state drug dealer. So in 2019, the city of St. Louis spent $7 million to fund the Cure Violence program here in St. Louis. And now this is not a great development for that program. To give us more information is Katie Cole of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Katie, thank you for joining us today. I couldn't believe your story. I read it like three times.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. First, I guess we'll start with the basics. A lot of questions here, but what was exactly Jerome Williams's role as an interrupter for Cure Violence?
Sure. Well, Cure Violence comes out of, it's a Chicago-based nonprofit, and its mission was to treat violence sort of like a disease, to kind of, you know, try to treat it like a public health problem, get people involved to try to de-escalate violent conflicts, you know, before they got violent, actually de-escalate conflicts before they got violent. And so his job was basically to go into these neighborhoods and interact with people and try to basically help them make peace without resorting to violence at a time when the city was really struggling with a spike in violent crime, homicides, and shootings.
So this was what he was doing, and I guess people assumed he was being earnest about that, that he was really trying to help violence. First of all, before we get to what he ended up being, how successful was he as a person who, other than himself, other than a person who was trying to cure violence, how successful was he?
Well, I can't really speak to him very much. I actually have never met him or talked to him personally. All of my understanding of this is reading our previous coverage, but certainly in the first couple years after the program began in St. Louis, a criminologist from UNSL did an analysis and basically found that crime was decreasing citywide, it did not decrease more in neighborhoods where Cure Violence was set up. So there was some question about whether that program as a whole was actually working. You know, I think the argument in favor of it was that having these people in these neighborhoods was helpful because, you know, it showed that there was investment and people cared, but the numbers didn't necessarily change, I guess.
Yeah, I think that was Rick Rosenfeld, at UMSL, yeah, who worked also with Thomas Apt, formerly of Harvard, now with the Council on Criminal Justice. And I know Thomas Apt, in his book Bleeding Out about urban violence, said that Cure Violence had mixed results. It was not like a necessarily tried and true. So Jerome Williams now has been arrested because they were able to find out he was helping out a multi-state drug dealer. What was he doing with this drug dealer? And again, at the same time that he was working for Cure Violence, what was his role?
So he was released from prison, I believe in either 2020 or 2021. He had been serving time for a fatal kidnapping in the St. Louis region, and along with a couple of other charges, I believe. And he met a man named Ray Bradley, who was a drug dealer who was operating out of many different states, including Washington out in Seattle. And so he met Ray Bradley, and he also met a man named Morion Lindsay while they were in federal prison. And then when he was released, when Williams was released, Bradley got in touch with him and basically said, "Hey, I would like to set up shop in St. Louis. Can you help me with that?" So Ray Bradley flies down to St. Louis and meets with Williams, who kind of agrees to be his sort of liaison in the region, or at least one of them. And I will say that all of this information I'm relaying to you right now came from testimony from Williams himself in court last week as part of a trial for Morion Lindsay, who was accused of being the trigger man in what eventually transpired. So,
yeah, it was a murder for hire plot, and that person was just sentenced. So how does he go from, you know, doing what he was doing, supposedly trying to help violence, to deciding, you know what, this might be a good gateway for me to be a criminal myself? Does he give any explanation as to how this happened or why it happened, or if that was just his original intent anyway?
No, not necessarily. And I mean, he had a criminal history, clearly. And I think a lot of these people who worked for Cure Violence did have a criminal history because, you know, I think the thinking is that you can relate to people and kind of say from experience, you know, this is what you need to do. And so I think the thinking was that, you know, somebody who had been there was going to have more credit. But it sounds like from his testimony that he never really stopped being involved in criminal activity. He gets out of prison and then he gets this call and it sounds like he was, you know, this liaison. So I'm not sure that those two things are, you know, they're separate, but, yeah, he was involved with both.
Yeah. And it looks like too, that he got out of prison, and just looking at the timeline here of, you know, the FBI starting to look into his case, it's a couple of years ago, correct? Mm-hmm. That he got out of prison in 2020, but they're already looking into his case in 2022. Did Cure Violence hire him as he walked out of the prison? Because I get that you can hire people who they say you don't have involvement with the justice system, so they understand it. But if you have a guy who's serving 35 years for a kidnapping that resulted in death, and you pick him up seemingly as he comes out the door, that's how the timeline works out in my head.
Yeah, that's. I think that's kind of how the timeline worked out for me too. I mean, either he was hired in I think 2021 at some point, maybe 2020. But yes, it really does sound like it was a very quick turnaround because within 2 years, pretty much from his release, he's back involved and implicated in this murder for hire. So
what's next for him at this point?
So he pleaded guilty last year to destroying physical evidence. In this, he did not plead guilty to murder for hire himself. So he will be sentenced. And, you know, I think that was part of the deal is he pleaded guilty to a crime that carries a maximum of 20 years and murder for hire carries a maximum of life. So I think his cooperation was probably rewarded in that respect, that he kind of pleaded guilty to something that carried a lesser sentence.
Katie, as you mentioned, Rick Rosenfeld mentioned that Cure Violence had, you know, mixed results. Thomas Apt mixed that it had mixed results. But the Mayor Jones, very excited about Cure Violence. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, they put $7 million into it in 2019. And has the mayor addressed this situation or has the city said anything about this situation? Because my guess is there's some kind of not favorable implications about the way Cure Violence is being run here if something like this could happen.
Yeah, it was actually Mayor Crewson who initially proposed bringing this here, I believe. It was before me being here, so I'm taking our clips fact there. But Mayor Jones did make it part of her platform. I think they just haven't really funded it anymore. I mean, I think that, you know, it is not as big of a part anymore. I don't know that anyone's addressed this directly, but I certainly get the sense that that's the case.
Katie Cole, St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter, thank you so much for your time today and informing us on this story.
Thank you both for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, the drama continues in
good
the
stuff.
City of St. Louis.
Good stuff.
I did read it multiple times because it was difficult to follow and I kept working out the timeline in my head, and that seemed like a super quick hire by Cure Violence. At any rate, he's Chris Ronji.
Awesome.
I'm Amy Markscores, and this is the Chris and Amy Show.
Amy, you got 400 mil laying around?
I do. What do you need it for?
You can help me out of a jam.
Okay.
Actually, no, not me. I'm sorry. This is somebody else. You know the the owners of, I don't know why I'm laughing. This isn't funny. I guess it's kind of funny.
It's one of those. It is yet another story you have to read a couple of times because it just doesn't make sense.
From the St. Louis Business Journal, Kevin Morrell, who is the principal with St. Louis developer Green Street.
Yeah.
You know Green Street. They develop a lot of projects
yeah.
around the area. They have filed Chapter 7 because they are over $400 million in debt with over 60 debtors that they have to answer to. This is not good. $432 million in liabilities. And this is the owner, their jewel project mm-hmm. was the Armory St. Louis, right off Highway 40, right in the Midtown area on the other side
yeah.
of the interstate.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty cool, it is a very cool building. Apparently just a lot of debt.
So yeah, $432.2 million in debt to 63 creditors, which I don't know how many creditors a development company has. Probably a few, I would think. Maybe a lot. 63 seems like an awful lot. Did these creditors get to look at Green Street's history? Because if you're like the 61st creditor, you might want to make a phone call or two.
The 61st creditor. Like, wait a minute, you got how many? Yeah, how many? What?
Are you sure you're paying all of them?
Well,
is it normal to have 60? Do you need 61 creditors? Okay, I'll do it.
This is a considerable amount of money, sir.
That's not how that works. Okay, maybe it's not. I don't think I could have 63 credit cards because every time you try to, you know, get a new credit card, they run your credit.
No, you're right. This is more complicated than most people would understand, including us. We're stupid. We don't know anything.
I don't think we're stupid. I think he is stupid to have $432 million in debt. I'm not $400 million in debt, stupid.
Well, no, but I think the point is that it just feels like when you see stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
an average person could never, and I don't mean rack up $400 million in debt. My guess is this guy will come out on the other end of this personally fine. He's not going to be destitute as a result of whatever he's done wrong or whatever he's mismanaged or mishandled. But the rest of us who are just average people getting by, if you racked up debt like this, it could be mm-hmm. crippling to you
yeah.
personally.
So,
I think it's frustrating to see a story like this and wonder what in the hell this person did or his company did to get to the level they're at and the point they're at where they have to end up laying people off who work for them, who counted on those jobs.
Well, here's interesting, too, because as you mentioned, he has $432.2 million in debts. He has $5.5 million of assets, which doesn't even out.
No.
It doesn't even out to have $5.5 million of assets. This is according right to the filing. The filing also lists personal financial details, such as Morrell has $90,000 in credit card debt, and this one, $48,000 in monthly expenses, including $5,100 for entertainment. $48,000 is a lot of monthly expenses.
You gotta be going to the club a lot. On the weekends.
So,
bottle service, a lot.
So, Phil Hulse, or Hulsey, I think Hulse, he's the founder of Green Street. He said Morrell's bankruptcy won't affect the company or its business relationships. Hulse says Green Street has no intention of filing for bankruptcy.
Okay. So, I mean, I think this is what I'm talking about because Green Street laid off a bunch of people back in 2023 because they were already starting to have some financial issues. This is kind of what I'm talking about. Where the frustration comes from, because we see the average person sees a businessman, a business person run into this kind of financial trouble. And we all know full well that he's going to come out on the other end of this, probably fine, probably still with a lot of cash in his own pocket. He'll be fine. He's going to be fine. There are things that he can do to get around having to really personally pay for this. It's not like he's going to have to change his lifestyle entirely. And that's what's frustrating for me as an average person. And anybody who's paid attention to the story, and I imagine most of St. Louis has not, they may not even be aware of it, But it's just an example of, in my opinion, somebody who is going to come out on the other end of this perfectly fine, even though they may have made some really bad decisions, cost people money, cost people jobs, but they'll be okay. Whereas if it were you or me, we're going to have to pay for it. Personally have to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's a bit confusing about how Morrell is filing bankruptcy. He's the Green Street principal. But then the founder of Green Street said that Phil Holst, that their bankruptcy of Morrell will not affect them. Green Street has a lot of projects. We talked about
around the area, not just in the city.
Yeah, but also Urban Chestnut's home in Tower Grove. Also
the Kirkwood
Business Parks, yeah, in South St. Louis, the North Riverfront neighborhood.
Yeah.
They're all over, and other places in the Midwest. So with Morrell's bankruptcy filing, it shows how Green Street's holdings are pretty complicated with more than 35 related companies. The largest claims include $61.2 million from the Bank of Washington for Green Street's new apartments, The Rail, and Forest Park Southeast. Almost $60 million from real estate investment firm Acre, originator of Atlanta, for Green Street's Terra at the Grove apartment project. So how you just keep building these projects and owing so much money, how this happens over a relatively short time.
Businesses get the benefit of the doubt.
Is amazing to me.
Businesses get the benefit of the doubt more than regular people do, routinely. Even if they are... even if they're acting in nefarious ways or they can't, you know, they're not going to be able to pay their bills. It happens all the time. It's just, it's frustrating.
Yeah,
I think stuff like this is frustrating.
And I get it. I get to a point like businesses, right? They have to operate differently. And
to
a, lot of,
a point.
And a lot of times their ventures are helping people and you have to support those ventures because it can end up hurting other people.
Like this one.
Yeah. I mean, do they, if Green Street itself stays in business, because as you mentioned, there were those who were laid off, there are other projects, imagining, that will continue
to
go. Because of the apartment buildings. We need to follow up, find out what's going to happen to those apartment projects.
I do know this. You and I, we just need more holdings. We don't have enough holdings.
Is my Subaru a holding?
I don't think so.
Just a car.
I think it's just a car.
I have zero holdings.
I don't have enough holdings.
Yeah. But, I don't know what's going to happen to that space, so we will keep an eye on that because, it's a huge deal when you think of all of the people involved. And now the Armory is a big dead space, and I feel like St. Louis needs to keep moving away from the big dead spaces, like the AT&T building.
Got too many
building.
Dead spaces, and there's a lot of good stuff that's going on in Midtown.
There's
been a lot
the
of build
foundry.
Up. The Foundry's there. Topgolf on the other side. They've built a Target. A lot of that vacant area has been developed, which is good. It's good, especially when it was unused space, or space that had been occupied at one point now was nothing.
You know, and we're going to be at SLU on January 31st before the Billikens Blizzard.
A
week from tomorrow. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll be broadcasting live from SLU. But just talking to friends who went to SLU, 20 years ago, they were like, oh my gosh, that whole area with Midtown? I can't imagine having a Target and a Topgolf and the Foundry and all of those restaurants. It is very cool where that is built up. Not to mention City Park being so close with Downtown West butting up to it.
And it's a little bit of a walk if you're on the SLU campus and you have to cross the interstate to go over to where Topgolf and where that Target and all that is. But it's still walkable.
Yeah.
You know, it's in the general area. There was nothing over there before.
Bikeable.
Definitely bikeable. That's Amy Marks Kors. I'm Chris Ranji. Did you know that you can listen to KMOX by telling Alexa to play KMOX? Yeah. You can listen to this show and the podcasts by telling Alexa to play the Chris and Amy show. It happens. I swear. Try it. It's awesome. When we come back, Maria Kina will join us, a story we were discussing earlier today. And she is going to be with us from the KMOX newsroom next.
Well, I was listening to Total Information AM this morning, and I heard the dulcet tones of Maria Kina.
That's the show on before us.
It is the show that's on before us. It's the show to which I wake up every single morning. And I heard yet again in the news the Westlake landfill, the Bridgeton landfill, and radioactive contamination. And I wanted to know exactly what the update is now with that situation. And so we have joining us now KMOX reporter Maria Kina. Maria, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, like I said this morning, I heard your story about the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency saying there is a, quote, high likelihood that now the Bridgeton landfill has radioactive contamination, or that it's closer to the surface than they originally thought. Can you kind of clarify what that new development is?
Yes. First of all, it's the Missouri Department of Natural Resources that sent the letter to the
That's
EPA
right.
saying
right.
there is a it's the probability is very high that there is radioactive contamination where the burn is going on. You know, for years they have said, oh, there's nothing happening there. You know, it's burning, but yes, there's no contamination. Well, now there is. And I think the people who live there, and certainly Dawn Chapman from Just Moms STL, who has been dealing with this situation for years and years, knows exactly what's going on there, even though they didn't want to admit it at the time. So the EPA has a plan to clean all of this up, which they still have not started as yet. So needless to say, those people that live out there are way disturbed and way worried with this. Even the fire chief out in that area, when he saw the letter that got, I think it was on Friday he saw the letter, he was pretty upset, and he called Dawn. So it's just a horrible situation.
Do we know what changed, why suddenly they believe that there is a radioactive issue and they did not before?
Because apparently they never inspected it before.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. I know. It's hard. It's you can't believe it with as many years as it's been.
So, Maria, Ranj and I were looking at our Google Maps today because with the Bridgeton landfill and the Westlake landfill, exactly where they are near the airport, is the Bridgeton landfill and Westlake there two separate parts of the same landfill?
Well, the Bridgeton landfill, it's a very large area, and the Bridgeton landfill is where the burn is happening. So that's the area that, which I can't understand because they've gone in there and covered that up. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't understand that it's that it wasn't ever tested before. But it's not only those areas. We're talking about Coldwater Creek as well. That whole area out there is contaminated. And in recent months, last year, towards late fall, they went in and said, oh, there are homes there. Now we have to go dig up because there's reason to believe there's contamination in there. So there are homes where people's backyards are literally being dug up for radiation. So the people don't even know that they might be being exposed to this because that was something they never dealt with before. And, you know, when you look at Janna Elementary School, that's still closed. And if you remember that controversy, a private group came in and said, this is bad, it's contaminated. And then the EPA said, oh, no, that's not the case. So they went in there and did some digging, and that school will never open again.
So, yeah, I mean, if just looking at a map of these two landfills, there are two areas where they believe there's radioactive material or material that's been impacted by radioactive waste. So this cleanup, which has been delayed in the past, and it's supposed to cost upwards of $400 million, when is that going to begin? Do we have any indication of when they're going to start to do that? And do we have any indication that it'll be sufficient when they do?
No to both questions. There is no date that they have given. They say they have a plan in place. And Dawn Chapman told me she thinks it's probably a plan that's pretty good and could probably remediate the area, but we don't have a date on that yet. And every day that goes by, more people are being exposed to this and then becoming sick. Because like Dawn said in the interview with her last night, she says, there's a whole generation here that's living around this right now. that is going to become sick.
Why? Why is no one, and I mean no one meaning those with the power like the EPA, why are they not doing anything?
I don't understand about the EPA. I mean, that's their job, to make sure that people are safe. And why this has gone on for so many years, why it's been allowed to go on for so many years, is mind-boggling to me. Now, Senator Hawley has been very involved with this because he wants to get the RECA funds to the people that live in this contaminated area. And the House has just blocked it the whole time. They did go ahead last year and they passed the RECA law for one state, which was Utah. And, you know, Missouri is not the only state that has contamination. There are others.
Oh, right across the river in Illinois, in the Metro East.
Yes, right. So he said that maybe it was going to be introduced as early as today, another bill on RECA. But now the Senate approved it. It's the House that has sat on it like this, and I don't have any idea why.
So, Maria, in your reporting and the people you have talked to, clearly they're upset about it. You mentioned the fire chief out there who was upset upon learning what he learned. And Don Chapman, of course, has been on top of all of this. Are you hearing from anybody else about this? Are you hearing from other people who might be affected or at least have a feeling on it or a vested interest in it?
Well, there's people, you know, like they have a special Facebook group that deals with this all the time and makes posts. I have not recently spoken with anyone about this, not with this latest letter that just came out. But I do know that, you know, and the thing that's really disturbing about this, it isn't like the people can just sell their homes and leave. They can't do that. Are you going to sell that home to somebody else who doesn't know? You can't do that. So I don't know what the answer is here if they don't get in there and start cleaning this up. I mean, the very fact that you know it's burning, that kind of tells you something.
Yeah,
something's not right.
Yeah, and Maria, if I understand this right, the EPA is nearing the end, according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, nearing the end of a process to plan an excavation of much of the radioactive waste from the landfill. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is overseeing the cleanup of Coldwater Creek. So the EPA is almost done making the plan that you mentioned to clear up Westlake, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has already started cleaning Coldwater Creek?
Yes, but the Army Corps of Engineers was pretty resistant to this. If you remember this, I'm talking about Jana, the school. And at every turn, the people who are exposed to this, who are living through this every day, have tried and tried and tried to get some sort of concrete, definitive answers out of these people that are in authority who are responsible for the cleanup, and they can't do it. And that's, you know, for the first time I heard in Dawn's voice, she was a bit pessimistic.
Yeah.
And I think just tired of fighting for so long.
And I guess my question is too, how do you clean up Coldwater Creek if you haven't cleaned up the landfill yet? Like, isn't all of that still leaking?
That's the thing. I don't know that we really know for sure what's happening with it. If there's an area that they haven't gone in there and inspected, then nobody knows. They don't know. The people that the residents don't know. So I don't know what the answer is to that.
Well, Maria,
but I do know that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I do know that every time they go and dig someplace else, they're like, there's some more.
Yeah,
they find more.
That's wild to me that it hasn't been thoroughly examined, because this fire started 15 years ago. Or at least they discovered the fire 15 years ago. So you would think they would know exactly where all the problem areas are on that property, because they're all right there.
Yeah, and my question would be, how common are these subsurface non-oxygen fires?
The smoldering fires?
The smoldering fires.
That's the only one I know of.
I know.
Well, yeah. That's one of the things that Dawn said, because I said, why did they not inspect this area? And she says, well, they say if they poke holes in it, that'll release oxygen and it could make it spread. So, you know, the people that are supposed to be knowledgeable about this, I don't know how much they really know.
All right. Well, Maria, we appreciate the reporting and you working on the story and covering it. If there's anything else, we'll talk to you again. And we know you'll keep us updated.
I will. Take care.
That is Maria Kina from the KMOX newsroom. Again, I don't know the science behind this. You would think that a fire that's been around for 15 years, constantly simmering, if there was a way to put it out, they would do it. I would think. I don't know. Unless they just thought, you know, it'll be fine. It's never going to reach the waste.
Yeah.
The nuclear waste that's there, so it shouldn't be a problem. But it seems like the kind of thing that if they could handle it, they would handle it.
Well, there's the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. There's the EPA. There's the Army Corps of Engineers. According to the Missouri Independent story, when we talked about this, my goodness, with Allison Kite, a reporter for the Missouri Independent, I think there was also the Atomic Energy Commission that doesn't exist anymore. And so all of the documentation is spread out between all of these different organizations, as well as departments that don't exist, no longer exist. People are shifting the blame or saying, well, this is not our problem. This goes to them. And then it goes back and forth. It does blow my mind. And I feel like the last 20 minutes have been an awful lot of frustration between this story and Green Street with what is going on here. How do things get so out of hand?
Yeah,
this should be a huge story.
The stories here are I keep saying this should be the thing. We should start every single show with, oh my God, there's an underground fire near nuclear waste. And it's right by us.
Did you watch?
This should be the first thing we talk about every day.
Did you watch the HBO documentary Atomic Homefront?
I have not seen that one.
So I saw parts of it. I think when
that's
it
first several
came
years
out.
Old.
Yeah,
you know?
Several years.
2017.
Mm-hmm. I want to watch that again because that to me, even the name of that documentary, Atomic Homefront, this should be the top story in the area, but also a pretty darn big story nationally. Kudos to Josh Hawley for pushing this issue so hard. And I don't know if it's just that.
I hope he stays on it.
I don't know if it's people in D.C. They're so busy with other things that they don't get it. Okay, well, because I would say this. If you're in D.C. and you only have Josh Hawley's word and his admonition, I mean, as well as Don Chapman, right, and the people in St. Louis, but they're not your constituents. And you're looking at the EPA and going, well, I don't see any urgency from them. And you're looking at other federal departments and wondering, well, if this is such a big deal, where's the urgency? Is that why they're not acting? I don't know, but it is pretty wild.
I wonder if it's the area it happens to be, if maybe there aren't enough people that take it seriously for some reason. I don't know that if this were burning close to Ledoux, maybe there would be action.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I do feel like, and this is to, you know, Don Chapman and Josh Hawley, even Cori Bush, when she was a representative, they were bringing attention to this issue. And I feel like it is gaining some momentum. It went from zero to some.
That's Amy Markscores. I'm Chris Ranji. Of course, KMOX will continue to cover this story. We will as well. Any developments, and maybe we'll push for some developments here. Something has to be done, though. There's no question about that. Chris and Amy on KMOX. Amy Markscores and Chris Ranji on KMOX. The Dave Glover Show is coming up in a few moments, and we are with you up until that point. And we're taking your calls whenever, 314-436-7900. You can always get that Odyssey app where you can listen to the show live. And you download it onto your phone, obviously, and directly from the phone, from the app, you can record a message and send it to the show. But we're going to take a call. John is in St. Louis with us on KMOX. Hi, John.
Hello. Hi. I used to work at Mallinckrodt Chemical, and a lot of that material that you're talking about is from Building 238. That was part of the Manhattan Project. And we used to clean presses, a thorium and a tantalite press. And the thorium was highly radioactive. We had to wear masks, plastic masks with air hoses, and one guy would be on each side of the press, and we would have many frames in the press. We would drop that cake down into a pan, and we would hoe it down a chute to drums. And we would get about 12 drums a shift from each press. They had plastic liners in these black 55-gallon drums, and they would be loaded by a fart truck on a truck outside, on a trailer outside, and then they would be hauled up to where they're at now. What is it, Coldwater Creek or whatever? Yeah. And these drums had, if they find some of these up there, they've got gray paint on them where we had the lot number on the gray paint. I'm 80, going to be 89 years old. And like I said, I worked in building 238. That building is now torn down. I understand one friend of mine that worked there up until about 25 years ago. He retired after 40 years there, and he told me that they tore the building down. They dug 15 feet down to get all that contaminated soil up. But that's where that stuff comes from. That is part of the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, I would think that all of the stuff that you're talking about, the barrels and everything that were left there or buried there or wherever it is now, that people would know. People who work there now or are in the area, they would have to know where that stuff is. Well, and if it's findable, and if they can excavate that and get it out of there, you would think somebody would know about
this.
Well,
some of that was cleaned up, but the ground was already contaminated. If you remember the Missouri Independent, that's the long form article that I talked about, I believe in conjunction with the Associated Press. It was just a massive undertaking. They had pictures of those 55-gallon drums, as the caller was bringing up, are mentioning. And they have pictures of those drums just piled, leaking, corroded, sitting on the ground, sitting on flatbed trucks. And, it's shocking that happened. And like you said, a lack of foresight, ignorance as to the nature of that material and how it would have ramifications. And like you said, too, the middle of nowhere, things don't remain the middle of nowhere forever.
Right.
And how we disposed of waste and material. Going back throughout history, think of how many times in history you read about cities even now, where junk and chemical waste and sewage is just dumped into rivers. Like that, there's got to be a better way. I can't believe we still kind of do it.
It's nuts.
It's nuts. In Chicago and near LA, sewage will spill into the ocean. It blows my mind that I get that it has to go somewhere, but the way we just dumped things into the rivers to the point that, was it the late 1800s when the Mississippi River caught on fire? I know the Ohio River caught on fire.
I don't remember that.
But, yeah.
But he was, our caller John was talking about Mallinckrodt, the Mallinckrodt chemical. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what was going on in the Metro East side. They were processing a lot of radioactive material over there, too. So it's, I know we have discussed a lot what's going on in Bridgeton, Coldwater Creek, Westlake, all of that. But people on the Metro East side, and like I said, it was very affecting to my family because my dad worked on that site. And we know that's where he got sick. And it's frustrating because it feels like there isn't a whole lot of recourse. And I know that Nikki Budzinski, the congresswoman that represents that area, is trying to get some compensation for people who live around that plant and have gotten sick over the years. We appreciate you listening in. And of course, that story, we're going to continue to be on top of it. And we thank you for listening in to us. We're going to come back tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Anything you missed is on the Odyssey app. You should download that app to your phone. Go back, listen to the podcasted show or any segments that you may have missed today or re-listen. Why not? Might as well listen again. It's good for you. Amy Marks Kors, Chris Ranji. We're going to hang out for a bit with the Glover Show, which is next on KMOX. I don't really dislike pizza.
It's pretty good.
Dude, who invented it?
Bob Pizza.
Bob Pizza.